This is an interview with Professor Dwayne Smith of the History Department and with the Center of Southwest Studies at Fort Lewis College. Dr. Smith lives in Durango, Colorado. Professor Smith is known as Mr. Colorado because of the many books he's written on our state's history. The interview is being conducted on February 17, 1994, in the classroom at Hesperus 146 on the campus of Fort Lewis College. The interviewer is Todd Ellison, representing the Center of Southwest Studies at Fort Lewis College, Durango, Colorado. Dwayne, there are many subjects which you would be well qualified to talk to us about, and today we want to focus on the subject of oral history interviewing. As we start, I'd like to ask you to tell us something about your personal background regarding your education in history and your training as a historian, and we'd like to ask you to talk to us about how you got started doing oral history. We know you got your 3 degrees all from the University of Colorado in Boulder with your BA in 1959.
And got my BA, MA, and PhD there. And while I was working on my master's thesis, which was on a mining camp, Caribou, I was fortunate to find some people who had lived at the little town of Caribou, which had burned down finally in 1905, but they had lived there, actually some of them back as early as 1880. So I started doing oral history. I just simply jumped into it. You know, you talk about being nervous. I just put a note in the paper, which never works, but it did work this time, and I smoked out some folks. And so I called them up and showed up and was every bit as nervous as you were, except in those days the tape recorder was about this much bigger than that, and it was a physical exercise. I still have mine at home. That's how far we've come. I remember one time on a snowy Denver, about a week before Christmas Day, I was walking down 16th Street to go interview a guy, and I thought my arm was going to fall off. But anyway, that's where I started to do oral history, was in 1960-61. Then I moved down here in 1964 to teach at Fort Lewis, and since that time I've done a lot of oral history. I never have taken a class on it, so you guys are all much more lucky, fortunate than I am. But I've done several oral history projects along with the histories that I've written.
What do you remember from those first interviews in Caribou?
I learned an awful lot in them. If I was going to do them again, obviously I would do better. I learned that you had to know the territory. You need to know something about the period of time that you're talking to these people about. I expected, I think, to get too much from the people initially of actually concrete facts, like in 1885, what do you remember about Caribou? Well, you really can't do that. Instead, you get an impression and a feel. These were youngsters growing up in Caribou. I learned that at that time, it's good to have some questions in mind, maybe even written down. Actually, I think I did my first interview by writing down what people said, and that was when I decided to go to tape recorders, even though they were huge. Doing once when you're trying, because I don't take shorthand, so I was trying to write down what this person was saying, and he was talking a mile a minute, and he can talk faster than I do, and I probably missed a lot. But I found that it's good to go back to the second time to interview people. For example, and of course now I do know. I do know the territory. Howard Hill would be pleased with me. Music Man, if you remember, you gotta know the territory. And I can sit down and talk to old timers. In fact, I mentioned this to the class last year, but one of the major oral history projects that I did was my local Durango history, and I went and interviewed old-timers, pushed it all the way back to the 1890s. This was in the 1970s, and I don't know how, because I never lead anyone astray. I always tell them when I arrived and what I'm doing and all these things, but one lady, a friend of mine, heard two of the older ladies in town talking about me, and I had interviewed one of them. And she was saying, oh, I remember him when he was here in high school. He was such a nice little boy. And I felt like saying, first place, she did not remember me because I wasn't here in high school, and neither was I wasn't very nice in high school. But I got to the point where in Durango, I can sit and talk with the old timers. They talk about Smiley. I can talk about Smiley because I've talked to so many of them. In fact, I've almost become a certified old timer because the people I talk to are all dead. Therefore, I'm now the person who can talk about this thing, these things. But that's an awful long answer to a nice question.
That's good. You mentioned that you learned that it's good to do a second interview.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about the difference between.
The first interview, I know you've talked to him about this. I never pop in anybody cold. If I don't know the person I'm going to interview, let's say someone comes up to me and say, you should interview Mrs. Brown over here. Well, okay, and I don't know Mrs. Brown, and I call up Mrs. Brown, and Mrs. Brown doesn't know me, and we really don't build bridges. We sit there and sort of shadow box each other. So what I do then is have the person somebody who knows Mrs. Brown call up and say, Dwayne Smith's going to call you, this is who he is, and so that I don't walk in on them cold. And then I go talk to the person. The first interview for me is sort of like, I've got to find out what these people know, what they can remember, what other things perhaps that I hadn't thought about can we talk to this individual about. And I don't go back and do everybody. I mean, some interviews don't pan out. Let's face it. They just don't for one reason or another. They aren't what you expect, but once I get to know a little bit about this individual and the period of time that they were living here or the occupation or whatever it is I was trying to find out about them, then if I can see other questions I need to answer or ask, and then I'll go back a second time. And I find that a lot of these old-timers like it because, in a sense, their future is the past. There's nothing much for them in the future, and they sort of feel left out, and especially if you go over to the Four Corners healthcare center over there. Some of those are pathetic, but when they get in there, they seem to some of them lose the hope in life. And so if you come along and you want to talk to them, well, then you can really help them out as much as they can help you out. And so I feel good about doing this, and I've been lucky because obviously you're dealing with senior citizens. When I started out, as I said, back in 1960, I could push it all the way back to the 1870s and 80s if I was lucky. But today in the 1990s, a person who's 80 or 90 years old was born in 1903-4. So you can't push it back like we once did. So what we're dealing with now are the 19-teens, 19-20s, 30s, that era time. And that needs to be done. I'm not saying it doesn't need to be done. But especially, for example, if I find out a person is willing to talk about the Klan, which most people aren't, then I'll go back a second time and we'll talk a little bit more about the Klan. The first time, they've got to get to know you as well as you've got to get to know them. They've got to have confidence in you, which is why I like to be sure that they know who I am. I like to have someone else tell them, a friend of theirs that they know, as opposed to me saying, hey, this is who I am, this is what I'm doing. But, yeah, I do. I think it's a good idea to go back for a second one.
What other tips do you have in terms of building rapport?
You've got to know the territory. I can come back to that. But you need to know what you're... You don't walk into somebody and say, tell me all that you can remember about life in Silverton or life in Durango. You've got to have some questions to sort of open up some things for them, and you've got to be alert enough as when they're talking that you can pick up things to catch up on later. And you've got to watch people, and I didn't really realize this until I was interviewing Nellie Spencer. Nellie was the lady when I came in 1964, lived down in the little house that used to sit right down next to the fire station, which was the last parlor house in Durango, and Nellie Spencer was the last madam. We can talk about the wages of sin being death, but Nellie Spencer owned everything from the power plant down to the present Holiday Inn. But anyway, Nellie wouldn't talk to me. She's rather eccentric. I came in 64, and this is an opportunity that you don't get very often. It's one of these great myths and legends. You get to talk to a prostitute. There are certain types of individuals you'd love to talk to, but you just can't get to. Well, Nellie, I waited until the early 80s, 18 years. And Nellie was up in the Four Corners Healthcare, then called Eventide, and the word came down Nellie wanted to talk. Well, Nellie did want to talk, and she was a great interview. She was 92 years old, and Nellie had a very sharp mind. Her body was going to rack and ruin. I can tell you some stories, but anyway. Nellie was hard of hearing, so she said, but not as hard of hearing as she let on. And she said she couldn't see out of one eye, but not as much as she said she couldn't. And anyway, I found out when I was interviewing her that I had to write questions. She wanted me to write out questions, which meant in the interview we have talking, stop, talking, stop, talking, because I had to write this out, hold it up, and then she'd read it, and then she'd start off. Well, I found out that Nellie was a very polite lady, and when I was writing, she stopped talking. And so we had to get this worked out I didn't want her to stop or train thought there while I was writing something down. So I just learned I just had to do it by memory, except to write the questions out. So you've got this, just an example. You've got to play off these people and understand. Sometimes they don't want to talk about something. Okay, it's fine, dandy. There are two things that people don't like to talk about, and that's the Klan and prostitution. A lot of old men in their 80s, 70s, 80s, and 90s had never visited the Red Light District, which is down where the Plaza Shopping Center is today. But yet they must have got a lot. They must have learned a lot by walking by. Osmosis must have been an amazing thing around the Red Light District. And the other thing is the Klan. No one ever was in the Klan, but we had Klan parades here in Durango, and they burned crosses on Smelter Mountain. But no one was ever in it. A bunch of ghosts and sheets walking down there. Well, if you can get someone to talk about it, and I never did get anyone to admit being in the Klan. I know some people who are very suspect. And then when we found the Bayfield Klan records, the people were diving for cover because we had names at that time. But still, there was only one fellow who was on there who was still alive at that time, and by golly, he was in ill health. I was ready. I had him primed, and he died. But I got his wife. His wife admitted that. She was probably in a better interview than he would have been about it anyway, because he was in ill health. It had nothing to do with the revelation that he was a Klan member. He suddenly died. He hadn't been in good health for a long time, and that's why I hadn't interviewed him, because if they're not in good health sometimes, unless they really want to, the interviews can be very taxing on them and not a good situation.
We've read that some people think, at least when you're talking about some topics, that it's better to interview the person of the same sex. What have you found about that, interviewing a woman about prostitution?
Nellie was very open to me and just blew a student's project out of the water up here when this lady came down to interview her. Nellie had a great sense of humor, and I figured this out too. When she winked with her good eye, I knew it was coming. I knew it was coming because she'd pull your leg. Well, I had this lady who was probably 40 years old, and she was doing history of Durango, women history of Durango. And she was interviewing some people, and she wanted to go visit Nellie. I said, fine. I said, come along. So I told Nellie she was coming. So we sat down, and I started to talk to Nellie and doing my part of the interview, and I had told her just to jump right in. Just jump right in whenever you want to. And so we were talking about something else. We were talking about Nellie's background at this point. And all of a sudden, I said, do you want to say something? So she wrote out for Nellie. She wrote out, I understand you were a madam in the Red Light District, which Nellie had openly admitted was a known fact. Her name she used was Iris. Nellie was Spencer was her real name, but Iris was the name she used in the line. And Nellie got a good eye out and squinted and looked at that. Then she winked, and I know, oh gosh, what's going to happen? And she looked at this lady who was in her 40s, and she said, "Young woman, how dare you suggest that?" And it just blew this poor woman. She couldn't, her interview was ruined. Nellie just did it as a joke. She did go on and talk about it for her, but Nellie just blew her out of the water. I've never had any problem. I've never talked to anyone quite like Nellie either, I must admit, but Nellie was much better with men than she was with women. There's no question at all about it. I mean, that's part of the occupation. But out there, in fact, at Eventide, they had her at her table. They had tables where every meal the same people had to eat. Well, all the men, rebellious men, little old men, you know, the geezers who really were sort of halfway out of it, they put it at Nellie's table, and she was a master at handling them, just a master. I don't usually... Oh, I've handled delicate topics for Victorian America because Victorian America was pretty delicate. But I've never felt that a woman has ever... I've had more men actually refuse or beat around the bush on the red light district and on the Klan when I know darn well they're in it than I ever have women. So I don't know. I don't... I think once they get to know you and they trust you... A rapport's there. I don't think it matters what sex you're. Mm-hmm. I think you can do it.
Where are your tapes of your interviews with Nellie?
Oh, Nellie's tapes are in my study. I have very willingly shared... I have them transcribed. I have very willingly shared my tapes with everybody. I don't mind. In fact, almost all the Durango ones are transcribed upstairs in the center. Nellie's tapes are transcribed, but they aren't up there. And there's a real reason for this, not that I'm being selfish, but I'm going to use Nellie as the heart and soul of a study of the red light district because Nellie was on the line for 50 years. And you stop thinking about that for a moment. And Nellie's interview covered everything from pregnancy to abortion to drugs. And it's the type of interview that historians would kill for. Because this is a very rare opportunity. You might think this guy's sorted, you know, all I talk about is Nellie, but she was really the exception to what I've done. And there's a lot of material in there that people would love to get. Well, I want to use it. And once I use it, and I have done some things with Nellie, but once I use it, then I'll let other people use it. But if I'm not quite ready to write that yet, and people would, you know, they could use it, and then what have I got? I've got nothing. And Nellie is now safely up in Greenmount with all the good ladies. And we didn't have an earthquake. There were four people at the funeral. Four people, that's all it turned out. But anyway, that's the only interview that I've never shared with everybody. And I've got a whole series of interviews with her. The tapes aren't really too good because I was worried about what you said. If I paused it and then forgot to start it again... I could lose something, really lose a lot. So it's far better to have some blank tape than it would be to have a blank, you know, turn it on and by Jove, there's nothing there. That's what I did on most of them. I did not fool around with pushing the pause because this was too valuable an interview and I just didn't want to miss it. So the interviews are very difficult to listen to because we'll talk for a while. Nellie gets going, she's like me, you know, put a nickel in me and I go for half an hour at least. Nellie would talk, and she just wasn't, if you ask her, well, I don't know, how much do you get paid? Well, she didn't say $5. I mean, she'd sit there and she would go through a little bit, tell you, different times, depends on tricks, overnights, you know, there's all kinds of things involved here. So there'll be a period maybe of 5 minutes talking and maybe a minute and a half wait while Nellie's reading instead of getting ready for the next one. But actually, one of the real difficult things of interviewing is getting it transcribed. When I did my Durango main interviewing in the 70s and 80s, and Nellie wasn't involved in this, I started the early 70s to the early 80s, and I've gone on with it. But during the summer, the secretaries up here don't have a great deal to do, so said the administration. So why don't you have any secretary on campus? And the word went out that they had to transcribe these tapes. Well, I tell you, people were diving for cover when they saw me come out like the Black Death, you know. I don't know, gonna hide. They're typing like mad, and Lord knows what they're probably doing. They're trying out their hands, trying out some new method of typing or something. But that is the real difficult part of it. I mean, you can do lots of interviews; it's transcribing them. It really takes the time.
Have you done transcribing?
I have done. I actually did some of mine.
What have you learned personally from doing?
I'll never interview anyone else again. That's what I learned. By transcribing it, I learned, obviously, you want the best equipment you can get. And I right off the start, I learned very quickly where to put the microphone so it would pick people up. Because last thing you want to have is you turn this thing up full volume and all you can hear is a whisper. That makes it really... And sometimes the people you're interviewing do not speak distinctly. And then you've really got a problem. Well, you can adjust it because you've got a tone level and you've got a volume level here. And it's always important, I feel, to watch this. In fact, I had one of these that didn't. It failed me last March when I went down to do my thing at the spring training. I cover spring training for the Durango Herald, which gives me a pass to do all these neat things. But anyway, it failed me, and I lost a good half of a good interview because of it. And I, to this day, I don't know what the problem was. But anyway, I always have confidence in your machine, work with your machine beforehand, test it out. I will even at times, if I will, like when just before I start, I will try testing 1, 2, 3, and then back it up and see if it is working because... There's nothing is more heartbreaking than to find out that there's nothing on that tape. Sort of like when you don't do your VCR right. I'm a master at somehow failing that technique. But this is key to what you do. So I think you've got to know this machine, whatever machine you've got.
What have you found to be the best for you in terms of microphones?
Well, actually, what I've used, this portable type mic, as opposed to, for example, this will pick people up without a mic. If you've got to put it right, pretty fairly close to them. I always like to have a mic. As for types, no, it's just who or whatever they have. If I have a mic, I will always test it out before I go, so I know what its limitations within what I can find are. It's because you just don't want to mechanically blow an interview. I mean, you might blow one, but at least it better be your mistake and not the machine's. You don't have to drop kick this across the room, which you sometimes are tempted to do.
What other things can you remember that have gone wrong in interviews?
Not much. I've been pretty lucky. I only lost that one interview in 34 years. That was kind of crushing, you know, to lose that one. And, was it a great interview. I was talking to Larry Himes, general manager of the Cubs, and we were just having a great discussion about baseball. And it didn't come out. Really, in all the years that I've done it, there have only been two people who have turned me down. Most people are very willing to talk once they know what you're doing. And not only that, but the interviews lead to photographs, maybe documents, letters. Who knows what these interviews might lead to? Obviously, the interview is getting your foot in the door, but it can be a lot more. But there was a doctor in town, Koplowitz, who was really a screwballing character. Koplowitz was down on the corner of 8th and Main was his office, and he'd been a company doctor at RICO. And I wanted to interview him. And that rascal, even though I knew him very well, and I got along with him okay. And most people were scared by him, but you just kind of let him go. He was kind of a gruff guy. He used to live in the Blackstone Apartments, for example, and he and his wife were Jews, and when they would come around caroling, the kids would come around and want to go in the Blackstone Apartments, he'd pay him not to carol instead of paying a poor carol. That was confluence. But he never would do it. He never would do it, and he took it to his grave, and unfortunately, the chance to get to talk to a company doctor at RICO would have been outstanding. And there's another man here in town who had a museum up the valley, Kenny Logan, and he was always convinced he was going to write a book about Durango's history. Therefore, he looked upon me as a rival. And even though he'd been around for a long time and his father operated most of these coal mines around here, and he knew the coal history, he never would talk to me. He would talk to me, but don't bring a tape recorder. So I just would sit down and talk to him and go home and write all this stuff down anyway. You have to do that sometimes. You have to train yourself to do that. And it hasn't happened very often. So I did get sort of a halfway decent interview out of him when he didn't know it.
Well, other than having someone who knows the person talk to them before you interview them, what other means have you found work for selling the interview?
I always approach them that you are part of this history, and I would like to have you help me make this history come alive and save it. And most people are very willing to go along with that. They think this is just wonderful. Most people are, shall we say, vain or egotistical enough that they want to be remembered. When we got the photograph, we all became eternal, because you look at an 1861 picture of a Civil War veteran, well, there he is. But prior to 18, you don't see this from the War of 1812, or the Revolutionary War. You might see a painting of some general. So Americans have this bent, and in a sense, they want to be recovered from what could be called the scrap heap of history. And I will work. I mean, I'm not that blunt, but that's been one approach that has worked very well with me. I've never, in fact, I do quote a lot of these people, and I do put them in histories, and they can see themselves there, and I think they feel good about it. I really think they do. So really, I've never had much problem. I'll call people if worse comes to worse, and I'll go over and just talk to them. Won't take a tape recorder. Just sit down and talk to them so that they know I'm not trying to save anything, and that way it'll lead to another interview with a tape recorder. Now, the other thing you've got to do is you've got to convince them not to be scared of this. I've never used a video camera. Some people don't even want to talk to a tape recorder, and you've got to walk them through it. A video camera might even be one step harder, simply because you've got to have someone else there to operate the video camera, and you've got some more equipment to do. And even though some people say, well, you ought to do a video on this, sometimes it's hard enough to have them just get to put it on tape. So I never have. It'd be nice to have some videos of some of these people. But if you can't get that, well, at least you got them on tape. Or if you don't have them on tape, at least you have what they said transcribed. And I did not save all of the tapes, simply because some of them I gave them to the families. They said, could we have them back? In fact, some people found out it was the only memory, the only physical thing they might have had. They didn't bother interviewing grandmother, and grandmother died. And I knew the family, so I gave them back. And also, when I want to read an interview, just because it's the way I am, it's so much faster to read it transcribed than it is to listen to it. Sure, you can get nuances and things like that, but I have saved some of the better tapes, interviews, but a lot of them I didn't, simply because no one's ever going to probably spend the time to listen to them if I've transcribed them, so I just simply didn't bother. Which probably Todd's over here cringing a little bit. But.
Well, I'm wondering what you'll do with them eventually.
Oh, I'll give them to Southwest Center. Yeah, no problem. Nellie's tapes and all the ones I have, yeah.
Well, Duane, you've probably written more books on Colorado's history than anybody, and you've used oral history, and I think it'd be useful to us if you'd tell us some about how you've used oral history materials in writing history.
Okay, how I use oral history is, as I said when I started out talking about it, I don't expect them now, and I realize they can't, unless it was something really important in their lives. For example, if they went through the San Francisco earthquake or the recent Los Angeles earthquake, something's really going to stand out. A lot of things are going to blur together. And you have to realize that, well, maybe this didn't happen on June 3rd, 1930, it happened sometime in their life to them. And I figure that a person, look at my own life, I think a person probably 7, 8, 9 is probably firsthand memory down to that period of time, earlier than that in their life, it's probably something that someone told them. Unless they, a little kid, maybe if a house burned down or something, they would remember that. So what I use the oral history for is not particularly to say, well, let's find out what happened on this date. I can look in a newspaper for that if I need to. Rather, let's get the flavor. Let's get attitudes, feeling about this era, about how life was. I like to give people a sense of place and a sense of time, and there's no way better to do that than to use interviews. And I'll weave them into the story in many different ways. It's like, you know, this old story you hear. If there's an automobile accident out here, you can get eight people or seven people or three people to look at and tell you about it. They'll firsthand accounts. If you sit them right down after the accident, they'll all have different ideas of what happened. And that's true of history. When you're doing oral history, you've got to remember that. What you're after is what, how they felt, how it affected them. They can probably remember Pearl Harbor. Lordy, I can remember. I can tell you what I was doing on Pearl Harbor Day. But that's the exception to the rule. If you ask me, for example, if you want to interview me about World War II, I could tell you what I did in World War II. You know, I was over there as a little kid. I was in a scrap drive. I was first, second, third grade. But I can tell you what I did. I can't give you a date to it. And that's what I look for. And this history is going to be lost because it's a personal history. I can get dates. I can look at documents. I can read newspaper accounts. I can get that. But the flavor, the personal feeling...